I'm sure you all have to be aware that this year of 2014 marks the outbreak of the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. There have been lots of programs about it, and still are, and articles in the newspapers and so on. Probably one of the most rememberable icons of that First World War was a poster that came out in the early part of the war with a picture of Lord Kitchener with his military hat on, pointing out from the poster saying, "Your country needs you. Your country needs you." The fact of the matter is, of course, that our nation, the United Kingdom, is still at war. I'm not thinking of the war against IS or in Afghanistan or Iraq or anything like that. I'm talking about the war that goes on here in our own land every day and night of every year for the hearts and minds of the population. A war goes on concerning the needs of the people, their souls. A battle rages. And I want to suggest to you tonight, and I want to persuade you tonight, that what our nation now needs above everything else is an army of concerned, praying people. Praying for our nation. Yes, your country needs you to be praying for it. And it seems to me that the opening verses of Nehemiah chapter 1 has quite a bit to teach us about that very matter. So I want to take you back to Nehemiah chapter 1 and to the opening four verses of this chapter. We first meet this man, Nehemiah, in the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes, the emperor of the Medo-Persian Empire. We know that the month is Kislev, that is the end of November, beginning of December, either 445 or 444 BC. We also know that Nehemiah is in the winter residence of the king in Shushan, or sometimes called Susa. If you wanted to look it up on the map, you can still locate it. It's down in the southwest corner of what we know today as Iran. The name Nehemiah means Jehovah comforts. And as you read through this book of Nehemiah, you discover that he did indeed become a great comfort to the people of Israel. His father's name, we're told here in verse 1, was Hakaliah. And that's an interesting name because it means Jehovah is hidden. And it certainly must have seemed to the Jewish people that God had indeed hidden himself away from them for something now like the previous 150 years. Judea was originally invaded by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, first of all in the year 605 BC. There were three major invasions, that one and two others, in which various incursions were made to the city of Jerusalem, and ultimately the temple was burned, the walls broken down, the gates were burned. Many of the Jews were killed in Judea, and the majority of the citizens of Jerusalem were carried into captivity. All the important people of the city were taken away. The captains of the army, the mighty men of valour, 10,000 inhabitants, all the craftsmen and the blacksmiths and the artisans, all of them were taken into captivity. The only people that were left in the city and in the area around it were the poorest people of the land. It's at that time that Daniel was taken with his three friends that we read about a little later on in the Old Testament. You can read about that in 2 Kings 24 and verse 14. And after the Jews had been exiled into the Babylonian Empire, eventually the Babylonians were taken over by the Medes and the Persians. And then in 539 BC, the first repatriated Jews returned to Jerusalem. They came under the leadership of a man with a marvellous name. His name was Zerubbabel. I think it's a great name, that is. I always felt if I ever had a son, I'd want to name him Zerubbabel, which is probably why we never did. We only had girls. I can't imagine my wife thinking much of it. But here's this guy, Zerubbabel, raised up by the Lord to lead a group of Jews back to Jerusalem. And under the leadership of Zerubbabel, they rebuilt the temple. And then about another 70 or 80 years went by, and another leader led a second repatriation to Jerusalem. He was a man by the name of Ezra. And you read about the book that carries his name that immediately precedes this book of Nehemiah. He returned with a group of Jews in 458 BC, and they began to restore the walls, laying down foundations. But there were enemies of the Jews around. They wrote a letter to the king Artaxerxes, the very same king that we've just read about in Nehemiah chapter 1. And they wrote this letter to say, whatever you do, don't allow these Jews to rebuild their city. And so he issued an edict that the work on the walls had to stop. And nothing else was done. All the Jews that were alive with Nehemiah, whether they were in the Medo-Persian Empire or whether they'd returned to Jerusalem, they were all born under the Medo-Persian regime. And so when the opportunity came for them to return to Judea and to Jerusalem, because they had been born scattered around various parts of the empire, many of them didn't want to go back. That was where they'd born, been brought up. That was what life was, and they were used to it. So they remained scattered around various parts of the empire. But those that did go back, the majority of them that went back to their ancestral properties. Not many of them actually went to Jerusalem. So that we read later on in the book of Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 4 that in fact the people in Jerusalem were still few. So few in fact that the houses there had not even been rebuilt. And so it is, 13 years later, after Nehemiah had gone to Jerusalem, that we find Nehemiah there. And whilst he's, we meet Nehemiah in Susa, 13 years after Ezra had gone back to Jerusalem. And what we discover here in verse 2 is that Hanani, which is one of Nehemiah's brothers, comes with some other men from a visit to Judah and Jerusalem. The likelihood is that they'd gone on the king's business, because you couldn't just wander around the empire in those days. You had to have permission, you had to go on proper business. So they've probably been on the emperor's business to Jerusalem. We don't know what it is. But when they return, Nehemiah is very anxious to know how they've got on. He's not anxious to know about the king's business or what they've done. What he's most anxious about concerns the Jews who, it says in this version, had escaped. What it means is the Jews who'd returned from exile. They were repatriated Jews. These people who had now gone back to live in Jerusalem, a few of them, or in its surrounding area. And so that's what Nehemiah is concerned to know about. Those are the people who are upon his heart and mind. And the reply that Hanani and these men that were with him give is a report about Jerusalem's disgraceful state. Jerusalem's disgraceful state, which we see reported here for us in verse 3. The reply of Hanani and the men that are with him paint a very sad picture of destruction and degradation among the people and of the city. They say to Nehemiah that the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. They are really struggling. They are in a sad and awful state. One of the major reasons for this is because the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. In other words, the people who actually live in the city of Jerusalem live there in a constant state of danger. The city is open, it's defenseless. It's open to any robber bands at night that can just wander in through the gates, take whatever they might find. It's also open and in danger to any raiders that might come passing by during the day. There were always bands like soldiers of fortune that wandered around in the hope of being able to grab whatever they could. And here were these people, they were defenseless in a city that was defenseless, in a city that was littered and surrounded by rubble, with few people living in it, in a state of constant fear. The city and its population were in a very sorry and sad state. The city itself was a very sad and sorry sight. In fact, we know from Ezekiel, who prophesied at the time of the Babylonian invasions, and Ezekiel himself was taken into captivity in the Babylonian Empire, and he records for us in the 26th chapter that nations around ridiculed and mocked the state of the Jews and Jerusalem, particularly Tyre, the city now in southern Lebanon. The people and the leaders of Tyre said, "Aha! Now she who was the gateway of the peoples," talking about Jerusalem, "now she's turned over to me. I shall be filled. She is now laid waste." In other words, the people of Tyre were saying, "Great, this is a great opportunity. Jerusalem has been reduced to rubble. Its commerce and its trade therefore will dry up. We've got a great opportunity now to make money out of their misfortune." And that was the attitude of other godless people around them. But the most awful thing, of course, about this situation in Jerusalem was that this was a terrible testimony to the God of the Jews. It was an awful testimony to the God of the Jews. We've just read in chapter 1 here in verse 9 that the city of Jerusalem was to be the place that God had chosen as a dwelling for his name. Psalm 48 tells us that this city of Jerusalem was to be called the Holy Mountain. It was beautiful in elevation. People were supposed to look up to this city and say, "What an amazing, wonderful, remarkable place this city is." It's supposed to be Mount Zion, the city of the great king. This place ought to be a great and tremendous testimony to the honour and glory of the God of heaven. Indeed, it's interesting, the very last prophecy of Ezekiel, he signs off with this fact. He says the name of the city will be "The Lord is there." And of course, thinking about this earthly Jerusalem, the day would come when the Lord himself would be there and would ride through the gates of this very city in triumph with the adulation of all the people around him. But in the days of Nehemiah, just look at it. You can imagine the people round about saying, "What kind of God allows his people to live in a place like that?" It was a sad and sorry testimony, a disgrace to the honour and name of God. Now, I'm not one of these people who thinks of the Old Testament Jerusalem as equivalent to England or anything like that. I'm not into let's build New Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land and that sort of thing. That I don't go in for that. But as I thought about this, it did strike me that there are certain, you might almost say, kinds of parallels concerning the society and the nation that you and I live in today, here in the UK. Just as the city of Jerusalem was in a broken, bankrupt and ruined state, don't we live in a spiritually bankrupt and morally broken down nation today, don't you think? I mentioned this morning, didn't I, the matter of abortion. Almost, the average figure is almost 200,000 abortions a year in this country of ours. I think if you work it out, I think it works out about one every 3 minutes of every day and night of the year. I might be wrong about that, but I think it comes out something like that. We have in this country right now a gambling epidemic. The gambling epidemic really began in 1994 with the National Lottery. Prior to the National Lottery, you see, it was thought in this country that gambling was a bit of a shady business. I can remember growing up in Birmingham, and my dad used to have a couple of bob on the horses. So he used to go down to the pub on a Saturday lunchtime. I remember going down there with him, and there'd be a fella there, and he'd have a little leather bag, and he'd stand outside the pub, and my dad would sidle up to him, and he'd say to him, "I'll have a couple of bob on three-legged Nelly in the 2:30 this afternoon." And the chap would say, "Oh, Governor, fine, right, okay." And he'd put it, and that's how you did your betting. And they used to have a fella, you know, he used to stand on the corner just up the street, and his job was to keep his eye out for the policeman. He was called the bookie's narc, and his job was to make sure that the copper didn't catch the bookie. So if they saw the policeman coming, he'd give the bookie a bit of a sign, and he would bag up his kit quick and disappear around the corner. That's how it was done. Why was it done like that? Because it was a shady business. That's how it was thought of years ago when I was growing up as a kid. But in 1994, the government comes along and they say to us all over the nation, "Hey folks, gambling's a great idea. It's a real good thing. Think about it. There's all going to be this amazing money that's going to go to all these good causes, so come on, buy your tickets. It could be you, you see. Get stuck in. Let's all gamble. What a great idea." Did you know, I'm told, that one in every 25 television adverts, and if you watch any television, you know how many adverts there are on the TV these days. Sometimes it seems to us there's more adverts than programmes somehow. Did you know one in every 25 adverts is for gambling in our country? One in every 25 adverts. There was a programme on the radio, on Radio 4, a couple of months back, and they were discussing the problem of gambling. And they were saying that there's one site, one internet site that you can gamble on, and that one site alone has 500 different roulette games you can play. And that's just one site. You can take out your mobile phone or your iPad or your iPhone or whatever these contraptions are these days, and you can gamble all day and all night, every day and every night of the year if you want to. They interviewed a man who was losing £1/3 million a year. And it's not surprising that he told what had happened to him. It ruined him, ruined his business, ruined his marriage, ruined his life. They had a sociologist on, not a Christian person, and this person said, "Gambling," I heard him say, "gambling is the new cocaine of the UK. It's the new drug." I'm told that 25% of the children under the age of 16 are growing up in homes where the man in the house, if there is one, is not their actual father. And quite often a number of the children in the home have different fathers, and the man that's living there is father to actually none of them. You wonder what kind of legacy that's going to produce in the very near future as these kids grow up. 2014, this year of course, has seen the introduction of same-sex marriage. And the media continues to pump out so much disgraceful material. You've only got to put the radio on, the TV, look in the newspapers and the magazines. You'll regularly see all kinds of tripe and rubbish and evil stuff. You look at the adverts sometimes, and what are they about? They're all about these violent games, these monster things blasting everybody and everything. What chance have our kids got being faced constantly with this kind of pressure? And all the while, of course, God is at best ignored, and so often just vilely mocked. The trouble is, though, folks, that's not the worst of it. That's not the worst of it. The worst thing about it is that many of our evangelical churches are in a broken down and sad state. People, very few of them in some places, little or no evangelistic vision, poorly led, some of them meeting in dilapidated, very old-fashioned buildings, utterly ineffective in reaching the lost in their area, completely disconnected from their neighbours and the society in which they live, utterly unable to affect the situation around them. Just irrelevant and utterly ineffective. And that's true in many parts of our country today. So the question is, if you're a Christian tonight, and I am, how should we react? How should we respond to this? Well, I think Nehemiah teaches us in verse 4, because here we read about Nehemiah's deep distress. Nehemiah's deep distress. Now, Nehemiah had a very prestigious position. We are told he was the cupbearer to the king. Now, that doesn't sound like very much. In the old days, it used to be the thing that they would have somebody who tasted the king's food and wine. And the reason is, of course, it was done to make sure it wasn't poisoned. So before the king had anything to eat or to drink, this guy would eat and drink some. And they would stand around and watch for 5 minutes and see whether he keeled over. And if he was okay, then the king could have his supper. That's how it worked. But of course, like so often is the case, a title like this covers a multitude of other things. It's not just what it appears on the surface. And it seems actually that the king's cupbearer was a title for the chief security officer. He was probably the chief man to ensure the king's safety all the while, and especially in his private quarters. And so consequently, Nehemiah would be the man who restricted any access to the king. If you wanted to see the king, you had to go through the security system, which was, you had to go through Nehemiah. You had to be vetted. Just like if you want to get on a plane now at any of our airports, you're vetted and you're checked. That's what Nehemiah's job was. He got to make sure that nobody who wanted to assassinate or harm the king could get to him. A very, very important position indeed. And that's in all probability why Nehemiah, we find as we read through the book of Nehemiah, find Nehemiah was quite well off. It's obvious later on that he had substantial financial resources. Where did he get them from? Well, the likelihood is it came with the job. He was probably very comfortably well off, was Nehemiah. And so when he received the bad news about Jerusalem and the sad and awful state of the Jews that lived there, he could have said to himself, oh dear, what a pity. But you know, that's nearly 1,000 miles away and takes a long, long time to get there, and what can I do about it? You know, I mean, that's how it is sometimes. He certainly didn't take the I'm all right Jack Blowem attitude. No, no, not at all. But even so, he could have kind of felt there's nothing much he could do. But the fact is that this news shook Nehemiah to the core. It absolutely devastated him. He tells us here in verse 4 that when I heard, I sat down and wept, he says. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept. It's as if the strength just drained out of him. And he flopped. It hit him so hard. He felt sick at heart. I've just given you a few rather sad and distressing statistics about our own country. Let me ask you this question now. How do you feel about that? How did it strike you? Did it concern you? Did it upset you? In one of these discussions on Radio 4, a discussion about abortion and its widespread nature, they had a government health officer on commenting. Again, as far as I could see, not a Christian man. But he said this interesting statement. He said, the trouble with all this nowadays is this. When you say these things, nobody's shocked anymore. Got that used to it, it just flows over us. It's like water off a duck's back. Nobody feels a sense of distress or a sense of disgrace. How do we feel? Not only about the state of our nation, but about the state of our many churches in this country. How do we feel about the dishonour that's heaped upon the name of our God? Getting on for 400 years after this incident in the book of Nehemiah, the Lord Jesus Christ came and he wept over a rebuilt Jerusalem. And it strikes me that ought not we that can claim to be Christians, ought not we to be weeping over our broken down nation in this day and age? So the question is, what did Nehemiah do with his deep distress? And the answer is in verse 4, he was driven to prayer. He was driven to prayer. We're told here in verse 4 that he mourned for many days. This was not just some passing fad. When it says he mourned for many days, it tells us he was grieved in heart. He felt devastated. His heart ached for the state of the people, for the honour of God's name. It reached into the depth of his being. So what did he do? He turned his distress into fasting and prayer. So that's an interesting statement, isn't it? Because here he is, he's fasting, and yet he's still tasting the king's food and drinking his wine. He had to. He went on. We know that from verse 11. He was still daily in the presence of the king doing his job. So what does it mean when it tells us he fasted and prayed? I think it tells us this. I think it tells us that he devoted every off-duty opportunity to pray. Every off-duty opportunity he took to pray. And you notice that although Nehemiah was daily in the presence of the most powerful man in the empire, he took his praying and his deep distress before the God of heaven. That's where he went with his distress. Not to the king, although that comes out later. No, he went to the mighty ruler of the universe. He went to the one person who could actually do something about it. The God of heaven. That's where he went. That's where he went to pour out all his anxiety, knowing that this is the God who cares. The day came when the Lord Jesus Christ went to a garden called Gethsemane. And there in Gethsemane, he took the depths of his distress on your behalf and mine to his Father, the God of heaven. And I wonder, dear friends, whether the UK needs Christians who feel distressed enough about the sad, broken down and disgraceful state of our society, distressed enough to mourn and fast and pray to the God of heaven on behalf of this nation. I think it literally is a deep feeling of distress that will drive us to our knees to seek the God of heaven, who alone can he reinvigorate our souls, alone can he revive our churches and reform our nation. In a different context, it is the Lord himself who said, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." Your country needs you.